Welcome to Intelligent Edge Yoga, yoga conversations for smart, compassionate practice with Catherine Ann Flynn. I'm Catherine.
Hi, yogis. I'm so pleased that you have so enjoyed the first portion of the conversation that I had with Balaram Chandradas. I'm so pleased to bring you the second half of the conversation, where we move into more concepts about Ayurveda.
So first, let's make sure we define Ayurveda, and that Ayurveda is a system of perception. So if we go way back, obviously, we have to go back to my grandmothers, I would say. And so I come from a lineage where in every generation there was a, what's called a curandera, which means there's a healer, someone who cures diseases. Usually it's a woman, but not always. Men are equally capable of being, you know, healers. They commonly use the word like shaman in the modern era, but we call them curanderas, which means there's people who cure you. Sometimes they're looked at as witches, sometimes they're looked at as doctors, sometimes they're looked at as storytellers, sometimes they're looked at as, you know, grandmas. But either way, it's like old wisdom traditions. And so that was part of my life with my grandmothers, and just kind of folk medicine, folk healing. Growing up around native peoples, that's always part of your life to some degree. And at least you know of it, that it exists, whether you're actually being treated or cared for that way or not, but at least you know it does exist. So that was always in my mind. And then when I became 14, I became a vegetarian. And basically from that point, I was able to, you know, like a 14-year-old starts to think freely and becomes quite independent. And so for me, that leaned into understanding about spirituality and meditation. I learned about Buddhism. I started learning about other world religions. I had some very cool teachers and counselors who introduced us to yoga and breathing techniques. It was really blessed. So I heard this word Ayurveda. I heard about yoga. I heard these words when I was in my teens. And then when I started hanging out at this ashram with this Bengali guy, he would use the word a little bit. When he was teaching me about spices, he would say, oh, in Ayurveda, we use this spice to help you not be bloated. We use this spice to help you digest. And we put this one spice in the wheat flour when we fry this because it helps to digest the wheat flour when something's fried. And I was like, whoa, what amazing science. So I was introduced to kind of the food sciences of India and the East. I learned, you know, early on that, like, you should drink hot water when you wake up. I had this one Buddhist friend, and he had a thermos. He said, can you go fill this up with hot water? I said, sure. I brought it. He's a Swami. And he said, do you know the Dalai Lama taught me this when I was younger? He said, only drink hot water. And that's all he said about it. But I just remember being introduced to those things. And then when I started traveling with my guru, he had a very strict diet. And the diet was prescribed from his Ayurvedic doctors in India. And so I had to, like, learn how to cook a certain way. And so then I started changing my approach to cooking by making it more Ayurvedic. So I started learning and reading about Ayurveda that way. Then in the ashram, the same thing. We would always meet with Ayurvedic people, Ayurvedic doctors, just because India kind of mixes in the United States and, of course, in India, all the different kind of traditions end up getting connected in some way. And, of course, one day when I was like 19, I had an Ayurvedic consultation with a man, which is a great, funny story. Did you ever hear that story, the first time I met an Ayurvedic doctor?
No, not that I can remember.
Keep me on tangent if I go off. But basically, I went in to see this Ayurvedic doctor. He's a wonderful man. He has an office outside of Delhi in a town called Vrindavan. And he came to visit us, and he was giving consultations throughout like a weekend that he was visiting. And in that weekend, I finally got a time slot, an appointment to meet him. So he was doing free consultations for like all the monastic boys. And I guess I wasn't 19. I guess I was 20. But anyways, he came to give consultations, and I went to see him. And when I walked in to the room, he was standing up and he was assorting all of his files on the table and putting them into a briefcase. And I was just standing there waiting to be invited in and to sit down. So I was just standing there. And he looks at me, and he looks back and keeps doing his business. And then he looks up again and goes, "Oh, hello, what is your name?" And I said, "My name is Boaz." And he goes, "Well, welcome." And he keeps doing what he's doing. And he says, "Well, I guess you have some questions. What are your questions?" And then I was about to ask, you know, I had like a whole list of like, should I eat tomatoes? Should I do this? Should I do that? Should I had like a entire list of what I wanted him to tell me yes or no's on. And right when I was about to ask a question, he looks at me and goes, "Can I tell you something?" And I said, "Well, yes, of course, sir." And he said, "How?" He looks at me, and then he just like looked me up and down. And I was this very slim, very skinny, it's not slim, skinny, very skinny kid. And I mean, not a kid. I call myself a kid, of course, when I look back at that time, but technically we're young adults. So I was this very skinny young adult, bald head, you know, simple clothes. And he looks me up and he said, "Boaz, just be conscious." And then he like finishes putting his papers back in the bag. And then he grabs his bag to leave and walks around the table. And he goes, "Have you eaten lunch?" And I said, "No, not yet." And he goes, "Great, let's go." And we walk out the door and we get to like the second hallway to leave the building complex. And he says, "Which way are you going?" And I'm like, "I'm going to the right." And he goes, "Well, I'm going left. Bye-bye." He leaves and walks the other direction. And I just thought, that was the most confusing experience I've ever had with anyone. He did not help me. What was that? And so luckily I was already affiliated with learning from people like that. So I just sat down and I just started thinking about it. And I still think about it up to this day. And when I reflect on it, I go, that was the best instruction he could have given me at my age. And with my health problems, they were all caused due to non-awareness, non-mindfulness, that whenever I was eating something, I had to learn to just observe. When I was drinking something, I had to learn to observe. When I was working, I needed to learn to observe. And that was really my whole practice at that time, as I was learning about meditation and learning about yoga and learning about spiritual practices. And as I was like leaning towards the monastic realm and being committed that way, that was really my whole art. And I was thinking food was something separate at that time. I was thinking that it was, and therefore it was treating me as if it was something separate. So then I just started to change my relationship to food, and I started to look at my whole preparation, consumption, growing of it, in a spiritual way or in a yogic way, where now the whole process became spiritual and a practice rather than just something that I did that gave me happiness or distress, you know, or health or non-health. And I was actually very quickly able to reform my life and my habits and my health. And then, of course, I started reading more about Ayurveda. And so during the time when I was living in the ashram, one of the key things you learn in a Vedic ashram is Sankhya. So, of course, I was learning about food, and then I was learning the yoga system, pranayama, etc. And then I was learning Sankhya, which is the key thing. And so I say this because one of the key foundations of yoga and Ayurveda is this system called Sankhya, which is basically the Vedic version of how the world comes into being and how it separates, and specifically related to the human. How does the human, what are all the parts that make you human, and how do you learn to observe all of those parts and pieces? So this is where the understanding of the body comes into play, and the senses and digestion and human variety within bodies. This is where psychology comes into play and all the different parts and pieces of psychology or of the mind. And so then you develop a knowledge of where you can reform or where you can nourish the different parts of you. So rather than you just being Balaram, I'm now Balaram composed of many pieces, which I'm capable of cleansing, nourishing, resting, cultivating any part of me, because you start to analyze all the pieces. And we learn that within the yoga realm. We learn that within ashram studies because it's foundational and primary. That goes into a tangent of commentary on the current yoga world and current Ayurvedic world, is where people are practicing, utilizing the words yoga and Ayurveda, or utilizing substances which fall into the categories of Ayurveda and yoga, or asanas and pranayams, which fall into those categories, but their perception and their approach is still Western, to use a simple term, Western or allopathic, and it's not necessarily Ayurvedic. And so that foundation which I had was huge, because then when I started to transition out of ashram life, and I had to figure out a career, I had really wonderful counselors, and I wanted to go back to school immediately to study psychology and become a psychotherapist of some sort. And a couple of my counselors happened to be psychotherapists professionally, and they told me to just wait. They said, just wait. They're like, we're here with you because we're here trying to learn the things which you're teaching us. about yoga and the yoga system and yoga psychology, and we're trying to adapt these things into our practice because we're finding the limitations of our practice, and we're seeing that these have a more cohesive or holistic kind of connection and usefulness. So we're coming to you to learn these. Maybe it's possible that you could just do this and continue to learn and cultivate this rather than going and learning another system, which currently this has high value. And they said, just push it as long as you can. And if you feel like you need to have some other kind of accreditation and licensing, and you want to be a therapist, you can always do that. Like, that's always available. And then at least then your foundation in Ayurveda and yoga will be more solid, and then you can recultivate it. So that you have a true perspective, because learning two different languages at once is difficult. And of course, like we had mentioned previously, that I had to decide whether I wanted to study politics or religion. And so at this juncture, I had to decide whether I wanted to learn the current clinical model and approach, or cultivate this other side, which at that time wasn't very popular or very much practiced. And, so I trusted them, and I said, okay, I'll just keep learning Ayurveda. And I just looked around where were all the places that I could study Ayurveda. And I already had a strong relationship with Kripalu Institute in Massachusetts. So I started going there to study, and then I completed all whatever Kripalu could offer. And then we were very fortunate. We had some wonderful teachers, and we were able to cultivate kind of a connection to them. And then wherever they were offering further education, workshops, study, I just continued along those lines and kept studying with this teacher and that teacher and this teacher and that teacher, just as much as I could, and still do. Whenever I can, I have extra money and time, I'll go continue to learn and be educated. And I was very fortunate too that I had already a very comfortable relationship with India. So I had a certain martial arts teacher I could go study with. That practice natural medicine in Ayurveda. I had a few other teachers, and monastic friends who practice Ayurveda, and I could keep going back to India to study, which I still do, and I have a new teacher that I'm going to start studying with next year, and there's just constantly more and more education in that way. But the best education is just, I made a commitment about 10 years ago that that's all I would do. And that was the best education, that I just decided, this is what I'm going to do. And even though I have to do this seemingly alone, I'm going to do it and I'm going to cultivate it. And in 20 years, 30 years, when I'm in my 40s, 50s, 60s, at that time, I'll have something beautiful to offer the world. And because I knew that it was this big subject and I wanted to be a person, and I want to be a person that holds the entirety of the approach, not just techniques to make money. And of course, because I was a monk before, and of course, growing up poor, I don't have a lot of those anxieties about money. And I've been fortunate enough to really be blessed, where I'm always being maintained and cared for through these systems of Ayurveda and yoga. But it really did take a strong commitment. And then everything just unfolded, where all of my daily life revolves around this lifestyle and this culture and this vision. And by making that commitment of just speaking in this language, then you develop a mastery around it. You know, it's just like with learning a language. At school, you can learn a lot. You could have studied, like, I've taken, I don't know, 6 years of Spanish. But because I've never lived 100% in a Spanish-speaking country, my limitation shows up, because I don't think every day in Spanish, right? And so with Ayurveda, it's a choice I made where I said, I will live only in this country of Ayurveda, in this language. And therefore, yes, I have a certain education that's like quantified in hours. But really, the education comes when you make a decision that that's the only language you're going to speak. And then the nuances come out. You start to dream in that language. You start to meet people in that language. You start to write poetry in that language. Everything becomes that language. So I recommend my students and friends to do that.
You made a joke at Ayurveda school you're reminding me of, because you were asking how many of us were yoga teachers, and a number of hands went up. And you were talking about anxiety around sustainability and longevity of the career. And you said not to worry, because most of our competition would leave the field anyway. And then you laughed and everyone just sort of stared blankly at you.
They're like, what does that mean? So what do you take it to mean now after time?
I think that people experience, I think they experience you in a different way if you are genuinely trying to live the practice in its multiplicity. And I think with the demands and attractions of modern life, I think that's challenging. And so I think even if people can't name it, there's a disruption, there's a break between what they're trying to promote and how they're living, that ultimately encourages them to do something else. They might name it as, I don't want to teach 20 classes a week for the rest of my life. But I think ultimately it encourages them to actually be able to live the multiplicity, because you can't teach 20 classes a week and feel nourished and calm and balanced. So back to Ayurveda school for a moment. I had a couple of questions for you, and I think they're probably really just variations on a theme, because one of the questions was, you offer a lot of training in philosophy, but you also offer intensely pragmatic classes and courses on cooking and lifestyle routine, etc. And I've always been sad. Someone said it to me recently that they loved studying with me, but did not want to do anything with me that was philosophy based because they wanted to help people and people need physical help. Anyway, you do both. So do you struggle with needing to sell people on philosophy of trying to persuade them that it's inseparable?
Well, it is inseparable. And so according to my understanding of Ayurveda, it's inseparable. And you can't actually have Ayurveda without the philosophy, because the definition of Ayurveda indicates that perception has to change because it is a approach to life. It is a vision that has to be cultivated and understood. So, for instance, Ayur means life, but it means every single part of life, emotions, mind, intellect, every part of your psychology, everything that you eat, everything that you see, everything you hear, everything you believe, all of your limitations, all of your abilities, all of your culture, all of your likes and dislikes, every single piece of your life is involved in your worldview, in your perception. And so in Ayurveda, we just acknowledge that that's a reality, that everything you do affects everything else. There's no way around that. And that the majority of your existence does not happen on the physical plane. It happens only in psychological realm and within your mind. And of course, if you want to get very scientific or on Eastern or Western, you come to the conclusion that realistically everything happens in the subtle realm of reality, meaning your subtle realms, whether that's mind or even more subtle. So to develop a perspective, an understanding of that, you have to study, you have to study, you have to study, you have to study, you have to hear, you have to listen, you have to cultivate relationship with these subtle realms. And you have to spend time with someone who actually thinks and sees that way, not just by theory, but by reality too. But that theory at first is good enough. You have to just spend time with that. And then later it comes to life. So when people say they just want to learn the non-philosophical parts, you can let them say anything they want, and you can let them have the approach that they want, but it's inseparable. You can't remove the philosophy. So for instance, when you're teaching other techniques about cooking, foods, music, movement, pranayama, you can't separate the philosophy and theory from it. It has to be there. You may be giving it to them philosophy light. The only issue is that it should be approached systematically and understood systematically for there to be quick reference of how to apply therapy efficiently. So because I see that, know that, use that, believe that, and see the benefit of it in other people as they can begin their practices, I prefer to put a great amount of emphasis on the foundational theory. Because that foundational theory is what's going to actually help an individual cultivate a different perspective. Or they're simply going to use the surface level of what is Ayurveda, or they're just going to use the substances creatively in an allopathic or Western way, which has shown to have its limitations and its abilities, of course, but it's shown to have its limitations. And so when a student comes to the path of Ayurveda, we have to ask them, do you want to change, or are you just curious? Do you want to change and learn new options and broaden your worldview and life? Or do you want to stay the same person just with different substances and different foods? And because no one's ever given them the option of perceiving reality different, they usually will say no. And so you have to somehow convince them that there's another language to speak, there's another way to see things. And usually it happens through consistent, regular association and through digestible amounts of theory and approach. And so things like cooking classes, body work, yoga therapies, all of that is a way where you can meet people where they're at in regards to their basic needs. You can help them cultivate new habits, slowly learn a new theory and approach. But main thing is that their faith in the subject of Ayurveda grows, their faith in the subject of yoga grows, their faith that there is something more subtle happening, there is another layer of reality will grow, and then that knowledge is cultivated. You know, again, this is why education should be in the early years of life where you can not get in the way of yourself. Education that happens in later years is you already have cultivated habits of perception, of analysis, of learning, of knowing, and those get in the way when you're trying to learn a different language. You know, everyone knows that if you want to learn a language well, don't speak your native language anymore. Don't learn it. Just go into an immersive state and listen, 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 learn, 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 learn. Don't necessarily learn cat is, you know, gato. You know, like that doesn't work. It works better if you point at a cat and you say gato. You know, like that's a cat. It works better in that, it works better in that immersive state. So if you're always using your old references, you probably will get the same result just through taking different substances, which doesn't always work. I can comment more and more about the commerce of Ayurveda. But again, theory has to come first. For instance, it's best understood when you, for those of us who've studied yoga, there's the first verse of the Yoga Sutras. The first verse of the Yoga Sutras says, "Atho." You know, that's the first word. Atho, or Atha Yoga Anushasanam, right? So that first word, it means now or therefore. And according to most commentaries on this verse, you hear that it means now, comma, or therefore, comma, alluding to now that you know how the world works theoretically. Now that you know how the mind works theoretically and how the body comes together to produce this particular effect, which you're experiencing called the human life, now that you understand that there are certain types of suffering caused by the body, the mind, other people, and the gods, now that you know that there's subtleties of reality called breath and mind and all the koshas, all that stuff. Now that you know there's this vast array of reality and you know the system, now we can teach you yoga of how to control it and disassemble it and become free of it. So, how many people that practice yoga have that foundational knowledge? 10% maybe, 5% maybe, 1%. You know, in the Bhagavad Gita, it says that one of thousands, and then one of those thousands, and one of those thousands will actually know how things really work, will really be a seer, a vaidya. And so that foundational knowledge is key because it's what is used in Ayurveda. So in yoga, it's used to control, master, and then become free of and disassemble, right? In simple, obviously there are many schools of yoga, but in simple, like classic Patanjali yoga, that's what we're leaning towards here. And then in Ayurveda, it's the opposite. It's now that you've learned how the world works, how the body assembles itself, all of its pieces, all of its parts, all of its functions, and how that works in a living, excuse me, a living body. In a living human form, with all its dreaminess and love and anger and frustrations and health and ill health, and its weird mix of spiritual ambitions and human entanglement. Now that you know how all of that works, now here's why you eat khichdi. Now here's why oil.
Oh,
now
Balaram,
here's
I lost
why
you for
it
a
works
minute
when
there.
You do this pranayama. I'm here. Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Okay. So now that you know all of this foundational knowledge, please take this pill. Please eat this food. Please do this asana. Please do this pranayama. Right? Then it makes absolute clear sense of why the medicine that we're prescribing works. But what do people want? People want to jump to the far stage of just give me the food. Give me this, give me that. And it's fine if you're just the client, right? If you're just being the client and the recipient, that's fine. Because the doctor or the practitioner is acting as your intellect and giving you the right medicine so that you get the desired goal or achieve the desired goal, usually health, physically or psychologically. But if you're going to step in the role of a teacher or a director of some sort, a guide, an authority, you better know why and how things work in their depth. And you should continuously put more and more emphasis on that. But again, if you're just trying to attach yourself or mind, or we use the word adopt, but honestly, in this world, appropriate, another culture, another system, another practices, techniques, substances, practices of any type, and words. If you're just going to appropriate those to be more creative in your next advertisement or your next gathering of people and your next aspiration to gain profit, adoration, or distinction, please stop. You know, that's what I don't want my students to be that. And so because I'm trying to be a big human when I'm asked to be a teacher, right? I see the gravity of that position and I say, sorry guys, we got to go back to the basics. If I really care about you, if I really love you, if I really hold a view of what I want you guys to be in the future, and to have mastery and a skill set, because this is what you're posing to me, at least, that that's what you want by signing up for this course or signing up for this education, then I have to do it, even if you don't like it. I have to do it, even if other people don't like it. I have to do it, even if the class becomes whittled down to a few, is that it is my role, my responsibility to this bigger practice to teach you what you need to learn today, not what you tell me you want me to teach you. To teach you what I feel is foundational rather than teaching you something you can take and, you know, use in the future. I'm sorry, but that's not my role, you know. And students get frustrated with that because they clearly are coming for those externals and they just want to use it in their own realm. But as a responsible person, I can't do that to the lineage or to them or to their future students.
You've always struck me. The compassion comes through. The love comes through. And your official bio describes you as tenderhearted. I see that. But you're also what I would describe as dispassionately blunt sometimes. And
usually.
But it's interesting because I've seen people definitely get ruffled, even angry. But I've also seen the same people then come around and become voracious in their appetite for more of what you have to say.
Yeah. And that comes into play that, you know, medicine, that comes from my commitment to serve in the best way at any given time. Now, mind you, when it's a group setting, the medicine isn't for everybody at certain times. And usually, if you're going to pretend to give medicine to a group, you usually just give placebos. You don't give the same. You don't give the same medicine to everybody. You just give a placebo, and you know everyone thinks they're getting certain medicine, which is what most education is, sadly. But in the realm of community education, is that it's okay for one person to receive medicine, and for everybody to watch and observe that type of medicine be received. It's okay. Many people are not used to that. So they get confronted by it. But let's say, in my responsibility to serve the greater health of individuals, sometimes medicine has to be received in a bitter form. You know, is that it can't always be sweetened in the right time or in a certain place. Sometimes you just have to take the bitter medicine quickly and ingest it and let it have its effect. Now, mind you, that's a huge responsibility, where it better be the right medicine, right? And it changes you. Medicine is supposed to change you. And no change happens unless it's slow. Most change doesn't happen in a pleasurable fashion. It's always painful. It's always distasteful. It always tastes like it's bad, you know? And so your immediate reaction to change is always one of confrontation, one of, you know, it's a little bit harsh. That happens. But the judge is the after effect. What happens in a few minutes, a few instances, a few years, the future in 10 years, 20 years, 30 years? Is that's the vision I try to have, is that how can I assist people for the long term? And sometimes in a very large group setting, like when I go teach for an institute somewhere, some of these students I will never see again for a variety of reasons. So therefore, what I teach them has to be profound enough that it has long-lasting effect. And that some people, due to wherever they are, will benefit immediately. Some people will think they're benefiting immediately. Some people are just entertained. Some people really do. Some people hear something immediately. Some people's faith is just increased slightly. Some people's faith is increased huge. Some people develop a great love for that subject because I love it, and they see someone who loves it. And enthusiastic about it. Other people seemingly have a very hard experience, but then in a few minutes, a few days, a few years, they realize that it was quite profound. Of course, every so often in there, I my character, my person doesn't fit perfectly for someone, and I might carry the voice, the form, the look of an abuser, of someone who manipulated them. You know, that all comes into play. That just happens when you're a public speaker too. And so there's always this harshness that comes out, sometimes projections that come out, and then sometimes in my years of growing up, sometimes I hurt people. That happens too, and I'm very sad about that, and that hurts me to think that in the years of growing, I've had my limitations, and that I've met people that I wasn't good medicine for. So that's also part of reality and part of growing. And ask any doctor what their success rate is, through their practice, and there's times of sadness, of what type of harm they've created people with: misdiagnosis, ill timing, laziness, ignorance, saying yes when you should have said no. Whatever it is, there's a lot to it. But when you say this. What was the exact word you used in regards to being unapologetic or
Dispassionately blunt.
dispassionately blunt? Is that in a setting where you're trying to be educated in a rajasic way? That's another interesting part. Is that in a when you have a short period of time to learn a lot of things, you have to teach quickly and sharply, and you have to expect or request all of the students that when we're in this education paradigm that they can just take everything as it comes, and you won't be able to digest everything immediately because of the pace. And that's why generally in classical approach to this type of health and healing with Ayurveda and yoga is because the practices are so strong and transformative and manipulative to the individual, and usually imposed from an outside source onto you, and then practiced obviously in time on your own. They're very harsh, bitter, and painful. They can be. And they're usually given over time with patience. And so with our current education model, we're taking and consuming things too fast.
I've always
And that
made...
means even...
Go ahead.
Sorry. Oh, I said, and that means also physically, right? Physically, if you're teaching an asana class, physically we're doing too much in one class. If it's an education, anyone who's taking like a 200-hour training, you do too much yoga. Mm-hmm. You know, you wake up sore, and the next 3 days you can't do anything. You know, it's not cultivated at a speed that is unique in your transformation, or that will support your unique kind of timeline of transformation. And so the same thing happens emotionally, the same thing happens spiritually in these types of education. And so I think that at core, this model of education which we follow currently, it doesn't work for everybody. And I don't think it works for most people because it's usually overconsumption, overeating of that knowledge. And therefore, the transformation happens too fast, and then it usually hurts you or harms you in some way.
I've always made that comment about Ayurveda school, is that it's a very do as we say, not at Ayurveda school. There's nothing about Ayurveda school that supports what you're learning.
No, yeah,
it's
intense. It's rajasic. It's meant to produce a fast effect, and you know, it doesn't match perfectly with the paradigm. But it's what we got right now, so we're using it. The other part of the bluntness, the unapologetic kind of bluntness, is. It also comes from our spiritual training, is that in our spiritual training and in our Ayurvedic training in this like authentic way is, you know, who are you? And when you start to perceive yourself as being spirit covered in various layers that are meant to support you and encourage you, and that your perspective just needs to change around it because this world is beautiful. Your environment is supportive, whether that's environment is the world, your body, your community, your current income level, whatever it is, the environment is supportive primarily, and that your perspective or relationship with it is skewed, then it's all a fun game you're playing, you know, or it's all this amazing kind of mixture of parts that you don't have anything to do with other than you're currently participating with it and choosing your relationship to it. And that it's stuff that you can manipulate and change and work with. And so there's no reason to be so attached to current form and limitations. And that you can change your perspective. And so this kind of, you know, this indifference or is just about, why are you making such a big deal about something that is external to you and which you can change? And again, that is very contrary to the current paradigm of education and even spiritual education that exists today, because it hurts. Yeah, even if you know you're not the body, it has limitations. And even if you know you're not the mind, it has limitations. And we can be hurt physically, mentally, emotionally, etc. And so you have to use a lot of caution. But if my role is to teach this theory, then a part of me has to be dispassionate, where I have to say, like, you're not the body, you're not the mind. Let's remember that. And then tethered to that doesn't need to be a kind of a kowtowing to your limitations or your current identification, but should be a promotion of, let us see all of your abilities and skill sets and knowledge and your environment and realm, and let's see all of these as positive rather than negative. And so the language that's needed to be used has to be more pro or more positive towards what you have is good. Let's use it. Let's actualize it. Let's master it. But that has to be given time to really think that what you have is positive. You usually think that certain things are positive about you and other things are not. Mm-hmm. And so it's a mixed bag. So if you have a mixed identity and you're not able to see clearly the different parts of who you are, then when I say you're lazy, let's say I use that term, you're thinking the whole of you is lazy. But if I say specifically, like, actually, your coordination is lazy, you haven't spent any time cultivating coordination, you know, let's use your mind, who, you, let's say you are more capable of coordinating mentally, let us use that part of you to inspire your physical transformation. You know, there's a way, but you have to see the distinct parts, or the language becomes a bit harsh. Mm. And that comes down to, as an individual, as a teacher, then I have to choose students that are able to work with that speed, or I have to adjust to the speed of the students. And usually one-on-one, everyone one-on-one has a very loving, beautiful, friendly, familial relationship. But when it's in a group setting, there's so many varieties of needs. And so you have to accept that, you know, one, you know, a fraction of people are going to love you and a fraction of people are going to hate you. And most people are just kind of in between with their mixed agendas.
Yes. So I guess we don't have time for Balaram's five quick and dirty tips for springtime balancing.
Yeah, we do. Why not?
Okay. all right. In which case, I didn't think you were going to go for that. I thought you were going to say that you'd given me the good stuff. Nuts to the listicle.
No, I know. We went on so many little tangents.
We went on so many little tangents, and they were all delightful tangents. Though I'm sad I didn't get to hear about some of your favorite coffee making methods this time.
Oh, I love coffee.
You love coffee and bikes. Anyone who spends time with you knows this.
Yes.
So I would love your springtime tips. And then I would love to know that if people want to spend time with you in person for both the philosophy and the pragmatic aspects of study, where they can do that, when they can do that.
All right. So first of all, if anyone wants to spend time with us, with me and my wife, or any of me and my colleagues that we work with, you can see our schedule on our website, Bend Ayurveda, B-E-N-D. That's the town we live in, Bend, Oregon. And Ayurveda, bendayurveda.com has all of that information. You can look it up on Facebook or Instagram or our website and get linked to that. And so we have activities all year round. Every month we have some kind of group activities. Usually every week we have some kind of communal activities. We do trainings in Ayurveda. We usually do 100-hour training in the winter. We have a great one that's in Thailand. The last day or two of November into the first weeks of December. We have a, you know, Yoga Alliance certified program there. And then we also have usually two or three other programs that happen in Thailand as well through the month of December. And then in the United States, we have activities every month here in Bend, Oregon, at different yoga studios or at our home. And then we have activities through the United States in Philadelphia, Kansas, upstate New York. All of that can be found online. Yeah, so feel free, call us, write us, email us. We're very personal, and we're pretty much always available unless we're immersed in something. But yeah, we travel. We just came back from Nicaragua doing a surf and Ayurveda and coffee and food kind of tour, which was wonderful. And yeah, you're all welcome. Then the education is very personal. So there's very few programs we do that are too large for you to be able to get up close and personal. Usually every time we meet in our settings, we do one-on-ones. We want to find out exactly what you're trying to learn, what you want to learn, where you're coming from, and we have no problem facilitating that. I mean, facilitating whatever goals you have. And if you don't have that formulated, then you're welcome just to hang out and just accumulate your knowledge. So we do a professional training, obviously for those who are practicing yoga and Ayurveda, and those same trainings are beneficial for people who just want to cultivate themselves. And we're also open to being invited places. We love coming for a weekend. We love coming for a day, just to say hello and to support communities. That's our main agenda, is that we simply want to benefit the entire world. And our goal is that if we're ever invited into a community, that our goal is to support that community in whatever way is necessary. So we'll either do that through our own analysis or through working with the community and saying, okay, what are the missing pieces? How can we share Ayurveda and yoga from a place that you will leave encouraged and nourished and inspired to keep pushing on this path? All right, so anything else there I should say?
I think you covered it all. And in case people didn't catch the website, I will also link it off of all of the show notes.
Perfect. All right. So 5 tips for spring.
Thank you for obliging.
Yeah. So in Ayurveda, there are 5 main tips for spring. First of all, the use of numbers is excellent for spring.
Actually?
Because spring has a relationship to kapha. And kapha is the mixture of earth and water. And so this mixture of earth and water in the body shows up as any substance in the body, anything that's observable, touchable, that you can feel. The body is made up of mainly water plus other things. So the human body is a kaphic thing. It's substantial. And oftentimes people just say it's mucus. That's like the old German English. Kapha is mucus in the body, which it is, and it's more than that, especially we have such a negative relationship to mucus. But it's this substance that ranges from solid mass, like dirt, clay, stone, all the way to thin, pure water. And so in the body, it's very rare you're ever going to find a perfectly solid mass, because even bones are made up of water. And then it's very rare that you're going to find pure, clear, distilled water. So the human body's mixture and all of its tissues are really just a mixture of earth and water plus other elements. And so in certain bodies, we call kaphic bodies, which means they are bodies that have a lot more earth and water than other people's bodies comparatively. And so they are usually people who are soft, slow, denser, heavier, physically. And then mentally, they're people who are stable, relaxed, calm, chill, loving, empathetic. They're people whose minds move slow, they gather information slowly, but they hold on to it for a long time. They're very committed individuals. They have a lot of reference within themselves for examining the world. They're very beautiful people all around that we usually consider to be healthy, and healthy in regards to that they have substance on them. But there are also people that we always look at and we say, hey, are you making sure you're not getting fat, overweight, too stagnant? Or we look at mentally and we say, can you speed up? Can you send me that email a little faster than you want to? There are people who are loving, but we always question, are you loving to the point of attachment? How will you feel when you lose that thing or that person? There are people who are, you know, everyone has their energy composition, and that has its limitations and its abilities. And so the kapha person, all of their abilities come from them being water and earth people, but that also shows up as their limitations. So there's a way to look at all of reality in looking at systems and patterns. And so when we look at nature and its systems and patterns, we find that springtime is the time where you really just need to look at earth and water. And you look at it, you say, is my earth and water, both in my body and in the world around me, is it lacking or is it in excess? So in Ayurveda, we just say, how is my kapha today? Am I lacking kapha or do I have too much of it? And so in the springtime, usually generic guidance falls into, in the wintertime, you become heavy and you gain weight and you gain water and you store and you store and you store. And so they say that that's what happens in the world, because the world becomes dormant, it becomes tamasic, it becomes hidden. Everything goes inward. Energy moves in and down and holds. But then as the sun starts to break through with a little bit more power, and as the winds start to move and the skies start to clear up and the ground starts to defrost, and slowly from the surface level, life starts to happen, and deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper. And so we see that that's the rhythm. The problem with the human is the human, unless you've really cultivated a very attuned, harmonious lifestyle with nature, you're probably not working at the same speed as nature is requesting you to. And so with the knowledge of Ayurveda, we say, this is what the world is asking you to do. The world is asking you to slowly awaken from your slumber of winter and start to, from the surface level or from way down in deep, start to warm up and start to open up so that you can blossom into a extroverted realm of late spring and summer. So, of course, there are all diseases in that realm. So people feel depressed psychologically. They usually feel like there's a spark inside them that wants to grow and move. So they're developing dreams for spring and summer. They're developing ambitions and goals, but their body and the environment around them and their current habits are slow and are not meeting them. So they usually get depressed because they have ambitions, but they're not being met with reality on the physical plane or even in the psychological plane. So there's that. Other people actually have a lot of weight on them, that they gained weight over winter. Some people, the world around them is warming up, so they start to develop mucus, not because it's coming from outside of them, but because it's coming from inside of them and coming out. So there's realms of Ayurvedic healing therapies based around how do we move from heaviness, dampness, stagnation, darkness to lightness, openness, dryness, expansiveness, and movement. So we have those remedies. But just to put a clause there, is that's what most people will read about in Ayurvedic healing or books about Ayurveda or even just any spring cleansing kind of paradigm from any tradition. But in Ayurveda, we say, hold on, that's not exactly what we're telling you to do, because for you, that may not be the right medicine. Because there are certain types of people who, through winter, actually become overactive, lighter, drier, emptier, etc. And so then in the springtime, you ask, how is your kapha? And they might say, depleted. I'm dry. I need more water. I'm dry. I need more oil. I've been extroverted and overactive all winter long. I need to rest and calm down. So there's that side where some people come into spring depleted. The reference we use is morning time. How many of you wake up in the morning feeling dehydrated, or that you immediately jump out of bed, you go running right away, you're awake early on? And then there's other people who wake up and they feel heavy, damp, stagnant. They don't want to drink water. They don't want to eat anything for hours. And so you have to look at both sides if you want to be truly Ayurvedic. But so if you do feel right now, as spring is coming, that you already feel empty from winter, you feel dry, now's the time where you can at least catch up before full-on extroverted summertime comes. So now's the time where if you need to sleep, sleep a little extra. If you need to eat, eat a little bit extra. If you need more hydration, drink more water. If you need more oil, take in more oils. Now's a time when you can do that if you're feeling on the empty side and the dry side. And please care for that. Because if you don't create a schedule, a routine, nourishing habits, it's like the equivalent of eating breakfast in the morning time before you head off to work, because you may not know where you're going to get lunch and dinner. So better just eat a lot before you leave the house. If you're one of those people, then really take care of yourself now before summer comes, because once summer comes, you most likely won't have the ability to focus and care for yourself, because it's all about extroversion, and that rhythm of nature is just going to push you forward to just be overactive and think about external things. But then the common issues for many of us who live in these northern hemisphere climates is that we usually do gain a bit of weight. We do get stagnant. We do have a lot of moisture in our body. And so five easy recommendations, let's say, are: the first one is wake up before the sun rises. That's the first one. Wake up before the sun rises. That has to be discerned, that you have to make a decision to wake up before the sun rises, and then you have to do it even if you don't want to. So you need to look at your clock and say, what time does the sun rise? Okay, it's rising at 6 a.m. Then you need to wake up before that. So at first, just wake up a minute before it. Whatever you can do, just wake up before it. And get up. And just, that's all you have to do. Just let the rhythm of the environment influence you. Is you don't have to do anything. Just wake up, get up, slowly get up, use the bathroom, you know, learn a list of other Ayurvedic things you can do. But just wake up. And then the second thing is drink water, or ideally water with sun in it. And in Ayurveda we say water with sun in it is water with fire in it. So you either drink room temperature water that was soaked in a copper cup or a copper vessel. Copper is the energy of the sun. If you have gold, gold's great, but most of us don't have a gold cup. So copper is the cheaper one. And when you drink that water, your body starts to become solarized or awakened by the sun, but in a calm, soft container, which is water. And so your body's able to accept it, and then that water travels through all of the water places of the body, which normally would just become heavier and cooler, but now it has this medicine of the sunlight in it, which is copper. That's one option. Or you take actual hot water and drink it. Boil some water, drink it. Or you take water, which you squeeze room temperature or warm, where you've squeezed a little bit of lemon in it, Or maybe you put a teeny bit of apple cider vinegar in it, something that has like a sour flavor, just mainly to the taste so that it sparks that fire energy in your body and basically ignites your liver. Your liver contains many fires, so your stomach and then into your liver. Of course, in that category would also include caffeine or bitter things like teas or coffees. That's why we love teas and coffees at that time. So they say springtime is an okay time of the year to, with a little less guilt per se, or a little bit more happiness and eagerness, that you can have coffee or tea in the morning time, because it promotes space in the body, emptying the bowels, of course, creates space, which is what we need. We need space. You could also, of course, take dandelion tea, anything that's going to do something similar, that's shown in nature to do the same thing. It creates space, it opens up, and it helps, or it creates potential for activity and movement as time moves on. So you want to empty yourself. The other part, of course, it has that warmth. Most people will drink a warm coffee in the morning, so you get that solarness there. It has the bitterness, that black color, which is going to, of course, create space and create some movement in the body with air, specifically not down but up and out energy. So the next thing you're going to do is walk. Just move your body in some way. So you start to walk. Early morning, you wake up. You know, if you want to take a shower first or not, that's up to you, or practice any other habits, but drink some water, or you might have your coffee or tea, and then walk. Just go for a walk. Or do some stationary walking, which would mean if you have some stationary tools in your house, use those, or you do some kind of yoga movement or a dance in the morning time. Just something to awaken you. Start slow and pick up the pace. Just create movement, expansion, space, and some warmth. Okay. The next thing you can do is use oil. Use oil, or just use your hand to touch your skin. So you need to touch your skin in some way. This can be done anytime during the day or in the morning, wherever you fit it in, before or after movement. It's up to you right now. Just touch with your hands, touch your skin. There's techniques of dry brushing, which stimulates external feeling or sensation. Of course, there's many commentaries of what it actually does, but in Ayurveda right now, we're just saying by touching the skin, you are stimulating air to move in the body. Okay, so you're going to touch the skin with dry brushing, with your hand and massage, or with oil. And then you use oil just to soften the tissues. It's kind of the equivalent of rolling a lemon before you squeeze it, is that you could slice the lemon and squeeze it, and you get some lemon juice out of it, but not so much. But if you rub the lemon and roll it and roll it and roll it, more juices are going to come out. And so in this springtime, movement and massage, or movement and touch, specifically starting at the surface level and then getting deeper and deeper and deeper, is going to benefit you in getting the excess out of your system, out of your body. All right. So the last thing is, start to learn something, or educate yourself in something new. Okay. Which is either going to cultivate the use of sound or of your hands or just the mind. The reason for that is you have to create a spark in your psychology in the springtime. And because what happens is, if you don't create a conscious control over igniting your own psychology, then someone else is going to ignite an emotional response or a thought process. So it's necessary that you take control over your intellect early on in the year, so that you don't get overwhelmed by other people directing and controlling your thoughts throughout spring and summer, fall, winter. So you have to ignite your own fire in your mind.
I like that
if you
so
can
much.
you, yeah, you need to ignite your own fire in your mind, ignite your own fire in your spirit, in your emotions, and your body. So you have to take conscious control over igniting the fire, creating space, and removing blockages. Those are like the key parts of spring cleaning and healing is create space, openness, mean empty your body, your mind, your emotions, create an empty container, ignite the fire either first, and then move out any blockages or remove blockages and then start the fire inside you. But you need to consciously do it instead of it just happening because someone else will direct you if you don't. And it's better to direct it through like positive motivation than letting someone else or letting yourself motivate you through negative kind of reform.
Yep.
All right. Those are five. Is that good enough?
So good. So good. But I'm just thinking that I can't ever imagine being your editor.
Oh, that would be horrible.
That would be the worst job.
That's Emma's life. Emma's just like, no. No. So the only thing that works is if someone says, you're only allowed to use 200 words. You're only allowed to have 5 minutes. Because for an individual like me, who's composed of a lot of water, is that I will just, whatever space you give me, I'll fill it. If there's, this is what kapha does. So if there's no, water always flows to the lowest place, the deepest place, and spreads until it meets its container. And so whenever you work with kapha, this is another kind of instruction for spring, is make a very clear container. And that's why I said at the beginning, five things is really good for kapha, for spring, because numbers are a fiery energy that give container or a limit. And so then when kapha starts to spread, it meets the limitation.
We lost you there for a moment.
Or it expands it. Or I just said it maxes out. You're able to spread to the limits of what you're given. And so when you want to work with kapha, use numbers, use time limits, use container of some sort, some form, limit on purpose.
Limit on purpose. So does that mean that in a couple of months when we move into summer, pitta time of year, we should chill out? Fewer numbers?
That you'll have to call me again.
Okay. Fair enough. No.
But you can use that same line of thought.
Okay.
You can think like, what is it then? Okay, if in spring we do that, what do we do in summer? Summer, we're already extroverted. We're already external on the skin. We're not going deep. We're not calming down. We're not staying cool. Everything's external, 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 which means if you're not doing that, something's wrong with you. You actually in the summer need to be extroverted, active, goal-oriented, light and thin conversation, light and thin thoughts. You know, like that's where you should be in that external realm. That's healthy for summer. But there's a tendency that if you didn't tether yourself with enough groundedness in the winter, that you'll end up becoming thin, dry, overworked, you know, exhausted. And so that means there's habits in the morning time you have to do in the summer. There's habits of recovery in the evening time. That all have a relationship to cooling down, relaxing, chilling out, softening, you know, or you tether all of those external activities to being around somewhere that's cool, water, river, lake, ocean, being in the company of friends, eating cooling foods, drinking cooling drinks, laughing, playing, recreating. Do you know what I mean? Is that it's, the medicine is inlaid in and mixed with the substantial medicine is mixed with the energetic active medicine in a really well cared for culture that allows themselves to change their routines with the seasons.
Cool. Thank you so much for your time, Balaram.
Thank you. All right, dear, thank you so much for inviting me. I'm very happy to spend time with you. I love all of these subjects and all of your inquiries, and I wish you well with your continued service to yoga and Ayurveda. I appreciate you making an opportunity for through this podcast to allow many listeners to hear from people that maybe don't normally get, you know, spoken to, or that, you know, not everyone has the time to meet in person. So thank you for that opportunity. I hope I didn't do any disservice. Please forgive me for any limitations I have or any offenses. But I'm happy to be here with you. Thank you.
It was a pleasure. Thank you so much, Balaram. Have a good afternoon.
Bye, Catherine.
Bye for now.
Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode. Please consider sharing it on your social media with your friends who love yoga. The broader we can make this community, the more hope this podcast has of surviving for a long, long time. And the more you offer your ratings on iTunes, the easier it is for my mom to find when she searches iTunes. So thank you so much for that. Everything I do is at intelligentedge.yoga on the Facebook, the Instagram, and the internet. Until next time, namaste for now, yogis.